Welcome to the Florida Roundup Presidential Debate Special from Lynn University in Boca Raton. I'm Phil Latzman. Great to have you here. And today we are doing a special statewide program. We are previewing the final presidential debate between President Barack Obama and Mitt Romney and taking a look at the issues that most affect Floridians as they cast what could be the deciding votes in the November 6th election. Let's introduce our panel for the hour. Mark Caputo is the Miami Herald's lead political reporter. He reports on state, regional, and federal politics and politicians. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Helen Aguirre Ferre is the opinion page editor for Spanish-language newspaper Diario Las Americas, as well as the host of her own Univision radio show and the moderator of WPBT-TV's Issues program. Helen, welcome to you.
Glad to be here.
And Ken Rudin is NPR News political editor and self-proclaimed political junkie all the way from Washington, D.C. Mr. Rudin, welcome to you.
Thank you, Phil.
And we will take feedback along the way from our live audience here at Lynn University or via Twitter. You can tweet us at handle WLRN. That's at WLRN. Just use the hashtag LynnDebate, and you can send us your feedback. We'll be getting some of that as we go along from our social media producer, Danny Rivero. So, first of all, as we sit here on the eve of another historic election, Florida's role in this 2012 election, again, looms large. I think I can look back to 1992, Hurricane Andrew, and perhaps the events after that that got Bill Clinton elected in this state that may have tipped the balance, maybe as the start of this Florida being in the middle of everything. But Ken, how did it happen that Florida became such a major player in deciding presidents?
Well, of course, everybody remembers 2000, as certainly President Al Gore remembers 2000, when obviously the Bush numbers were 537 more votes in Florida than Al Gore, and that was the presidency. But you're absolutely right. It goes back to 1992 because for the longest time, Florida was considered a red state, a Republican-leaning state. And when the senior George Bush beat Bill Clinton by just about 100,000 votes in Florida, both parties realized they have a fight on their hands. But even more importantly, I think what's so important about this is that while it may be the fourth largest state population-wise after California, Texas, and New York, it's the only state up for grabs. California and New York are solid Democratic states. Texas is a solid Republican state. Florida really has no advantage either way, and that's why it's crucial for both sides.
Bob Graham, the former Democratic senator, calls it a purple state. Hanging chads, voting machines, election laws. Mark Caputo, you're certainly reporting in the middle of history here. What's your take on why Florida matters?
29 electoral college votes. That's more than 10% of the total needed to win. Take Ohio and add Wisconsin, and they're one vote shy of what we bring to the table at 29 electoral college votes. You're hearing a lot of talk about Ohio. Mitt Romney loses Florida. It's game over.
And Helen Ferre, we hear polls all the time, and as a Univision talk show host and an editor for a major Spanish language newspaper, an opinion page editor, we hear about the Hispanic vote, the Latino vote. That, though, is not, if you don't break it down, it's a much different demographic here in Florida than in other states that we're talking about.
Absolutely,
right?
But it's even different when you look at South Florida versus the I-4 corridor. And I think one of the aspects that we're going to find fascinating with the Hispanic vote is that in South Florida, the large Cuban-American bloc tends to vote Republican, and that still stays constant. Though you are beginning to see a growing trend of more Cuban-Americans who are beginning to trend toward Democrats. But the I-4 corridor, especially with the Puerto Rican vote, you see something very different. And you see that also, I think, in Broward County and South Palm Beach. And that's the Puerto Rican voter tends to vote or register as independent, which is very different from the Puerto Rican voter from the Northeast. And these are those who have just come recently from the island and are middle class. They come with families. And interestingly enough, they can't vote in Puerto Rico. And that's going to be an interesting election sidebar when you look at what's going on, because there is, in Puerto Rico, there is a plebiscite on November 6th regarding Puerto Rican status, and both candidates have indicated, both President Obama and Governor Romney have indicated that they would support statehood should Puerto Ricans vote in that direction. But you look at that I-4 corridor, Phil, and you were talking about 2000, and that was, you know, that critical highway that made a huge difference. And those voters are trending at this point in time to be a little bit right of center, though because they're independents, it's undecided. There's also a real interesting district there where you do have a Republican who is Puerto Rican, who's challenging a whose challenger is a Democrat, Alan Grayson. And I think that might be part of what's going to be driving the Puerto Rican vote in the I-4 corridor, too.
And it'll be very interesting. The election could be decided in a number of different places here in Florida, and that's why we'd say about every vote counting. Ken, coming from Washington and really traveling around the country for NPR and the walk up to this election, how is Florida representative of the rest of the country as much as it is different?
Well, the thing is, there's several Floridas. You know, as Helen said, there's a conservative and military north. There's Jews and Cubans in the south. There's, as you say, Puerto Ricans in the I-4 corridor. We're going from Tampa to Orlando to Daytona. There's so many different segments of the state, so it's really not one state. You could say it's Midwestern, because the people from the Midwest come to St. Petersburg and Tampa. The people from the east go to South Florida, and you know, in Southeast Florida. And, of course, it's a Latin American state as well, because of the, I think it has the largest percentage of Latino voters in the country. So given all that, there are so many different Floridas, and that's what makes it so difficult to run a campaign there, because you have to appeal to so many different regions and so many different demographics.
It's also very expensive, too, right?
Very.
I think nobody is more as happier about the election than the TV stations, which we're seeing a bounty of money coming in. Mark, just briefly on the polls before we move on, and we're going to talk about foreign policy issues here for this first hour for the bulk of it, and we're going to transition into that in just a moment. We're also going to get the feedback from our Twitterverse, who have joined us through Twitter on the conversation at handle WLRN and at the hashtag LynnDebate. Mark, you've been watching these polls just going haywire over the past few weeks, and almost you can say, how do you trust any of them? Because one says this and one says that. And we don't want to get too dated. They change every day, though. So do we really trust the polls?
Well, yeah, we do. As we say, it's not the top line. You know, Mitt Romney with X and Obama with Y, it's the trend. And all of the polls are agreeing that the trend in Florida and nationwide is with Mitt Romney. When the president decided to get up at a debate and fall asleep, a joke actually that he made at his own expense, the president, last night, it made a difference. Our own poll that the Herald took showed that there was a 51-44 race. President Obama actually lost 4 percentage points as a result just of that debate alone, and Mitt Romney picked up a good deal of people.
And I think we're seeing that perhaps the undecideds are more than we perhaps thought and than what the polling is telling us. We are going to have our first audience member coming up to ask a question. Sir, we welcome you to this Florida Roundup pre-debate Lynn University special. How are you? Welcome.
I'm fine. My name's Joe. I'm from Lake Worth. I feel like... those people in Hofstra University with this question. Anyway, how much influence do the polls have on the way people vote? Remember what happened several years ago when TV announcers announced the winners before polls had closed in several states?
The infamous 2000 election, we're all staying up late for that, Mark.
Well, I'll take that. I think most surveys show that actually the surveys don't make that much of a difference. One of the things you especially heard from Republicans in 2000 is because the announcement of Florida winning came before the polls closed in the western half of the panhandle, which is on a different time zone. It affected the vote. It probably doesn't appear to be so. The difference that polls make is really in money. If you're showing to be up and leading, you as a candidate start to rake in more money. More money helps you have more ads. More ads get you more support. It's almost as easy as that. But it's not necessarily as easy as that. We have all these polls going on right now, and we have debates, but in Florida already 620,000 people, as of this morning, have already voted. That's 620,000 people, just as of this morning, have already voted. In about 3 to 4 days, 1 million people in Florida will have cast an absentee ballot. And that's before early in-person voting shows up. There's really a small percentage of people who are undecided. The question is who is going to be showing up, you know, both at the polls on Election Day, early voting, and whether they're going to put their absentee ballot in the mail.
Ken Rudin.
Let me give you a contrary thought. Here it is. I think when you see polls showing momentum, as Mark had talked about, I think there's a psychological factor. The Romney people were clearly down before the first debate, the October 3rd debate. And a lot of times when you see things in debate, whether you have better arguments or not, it's just what the polls say who won, and which is one of the problems with the media. We love who wins and who loses and talk less about substance. Because when you remember in the 2000 debate, going into the debate, Al Gore had a 5-point lead in Gallup. Coming out of the last debate, George W. Bush had a 5-point lead, and suddenly there was some momentum there. And a lot of people focused not on what Bush and Gore said, but like Al Gore would have these sighs, like, oh, you know, those sighs. And I always thought sighs doesn't matter. But I thought at the same time that... Is this on? But but I think there's a psychological effect that leads to people changing their minds.
And Helen, being in the middle of several newsrooms and being a news junkie like we all are, political or not, how much do you pay attention to the polls and where they're going?
I, like all the other journalists, I follow the trends. The Gallup poll that has Governor Romney up by 7 points, I find that margin to be way too high, but I do follow the trends of all polls indicating that there is an advantage to Governor Romney. What I do follow, though, is what's happening in the undecided states, and that's what I think. I think if there's anything that we learned from the 2000 election is that you don't vote directly for the president. This is all about electoral college math.
All right, we're going to take a break here. We're going to come back, and we will discuss foreign policy. You're listening to the Florida Roundup Presidential Debate Special from Lynn University. I'm Phil Latzman, our panel, Helen Ferrey, Ken Rudin, and Mark Caputo. We're coming back with some of your questions, and we'll turn to foreign policy in just a moment. And welcome back to the Florida Roundup Presidential Debate Special from Lynn University in Boca Raton. I'm Phil Latzman, and thanks to all of you listening and all of those here at Lynn University. Once again, introducing our panel, Helen Ferrey from Univision Radio and WPBT Television, Mark Caputo from the Miami Herald, and Ken Rudin from NPR. And we're going to move on to some foreign policy, but before we do that, let's invite our social media editor, Danny Rivero, who is working very hard gathering all the tweets that have come in since we've started the program. And again, you're welcome to join the conversation through Twitter. Our handle is at WLRN. The hashtag is LynnDebate. Danny, what have you been seeing?
What I've been seeing is the second that we open up the conversation to foreign policy, that's what people want to talk about. One question that I have from Max Octane is, can the U.S. government be a stronger voice worldwide if we constantly promote oil and coal technologies? Would anyone like to take that question?
Good question. Now, energy has been a major issue, and it was talked a lot about in the last presidential debate. As it comes to foreign policy, certainly the two are interlinked. Anybody want to jump on that one? Mark?
Oh, well, I'll just dive right
You're
in.
You're elected.
As I understand, the question is essentially, do we lose our influence by being addicted to oil? Well, yeah. That's one of the reasons we're embroiled in places that otherwise we wouldn't be embroiled in. But it is what it is, and the fact is your car is not going to be running on a banana or on solar power, so we're going to remain engaged in pretty rough neighborhoods, such as the Middle East, and it's going to remain that way no matter how much we drill.
So when we get into the conversation about foreign policy, which will be the topic of the debate at Lynn University here, the idea of foreign policy and how Florida's view of foreign policy differs from the rest of the country. Helen, you must be watching these debates and hearing these conversations and going, why aren't they talking about this? Or, boy, I'd love to hear them talk about something related to foreign policy. What have you not been hearing? It's been part of the conversation.
Well, we were, in the Hispanic community or Latino community, we were very surprised that the topic of immigration reform didn't come up until towards the end of the second debate. Also, the issue of there's more to foreign policy than Libya, though. Of course, Libya and what's happening in the Middle East is of huge concern. Fast and Furious was more or less introduced, but more as a jab more than a discussion of what we have with Mexico. Governor Romney is the only one who's really been talking about the importance of Latin America and the importance of trade with Latin America. And when you talk about trade, you could be talking about anywhere, but he's looking at it or talking about it in a way that makes sense regionally. But we really haven't had that serious discussion yet about foreign policy and what the appropriate role for the United States should be in foreign policy, especially when you take into account the effects of globalization. Part of our strength with foreign policy in the past was because of our enormous economic power. But today, that's really taken a turn. And as you look at the importance of manufacturing and how we've exported our manufacturing in other countries and our dependency in the Asian Pacific basin particularly, now you're beginning to look at different focuses and other, it's not necessarily that we've come down, is that other nations have come up.
Ken Rudin, it seems like it would be if 8 years ago we were talking a lot more in these types of forums about foreign policy with wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, even 4 years ago. But up until recently, we have really not heard a lot about foreign policy in these discussions.
Well, most elections do not depend on what happens in foreign policy. It's always been the pocketbook, how my family, your family, my neighborhood community are faring in economic times. So obviously, as we remember in 1992, the famous James Carville, it's the economy, stupid, because that was the issue, even though George H.W. Bush had huge popularity numbers, high approval numbers for his pursuit in the Gulf War. But of course, 8 years ago was the first presidential election in the wake of 9/11, so foreign policy, national security, homeland security was obviously the key issue there. But again, with unemployment over 8% for most of, just about all of the Obama first term, that's going to drive the voters to the polls.
And there was some surprising news from Cuba recently. The Cuban government changed the rules for how people are allowed to leave the country, and we'll start the discussion talking about Cuba and Cuba policy. Helen Ferre, you want to just brief us on exactly what happened in Havana?
Well, it was interesting because the Cuban government announced that exit visas were no longer going to be required in order to leave the country, though you do need to have a Cuban passport that's issued, obviously, by the Cuban government. And it caught everybody off guard because everybody thought that it made perhaps an opportunity to open up travel to be able to leave Cuba freely, which has always been strictly controlled by the Cuban government. Certainly hasn't given permission, allowed famous Cuban blogger Yoani Sanchez the opportunity to go pick up her numerous awards throughout the world. But what they did was, you know, it sounded initially like this was a big change where you had a two-step process. First, you had to go to the exit visa. Of course, you always have to go to the embassy of whatever country you're asking permission to go to. But you also had to get your Cuban passport. And what the Cuban government did just eliminated one step. You still need the Cuban passport. How the Cuban passport's going to be allocated to you is still going to be conditioned. And that's one of the interesting aspects of this. Of course, the next question is, what effect is that going to have towards the Cuban exile community or the idea of exile? Does the exile mentality continue to exist? Is it a reality? Of course it is, as long as you have a government that continues to ignore everything that has to do with human rights and rule of law on the island.
Well, Ken Rudin, I wanted to ask you, the Obama administration in the past 4 years has made overtures towards Cuba. They've eased remittance requirements. They've eased travel restrictions. First of all, do you expect that to be a topic in this final debate? And second of all, have they helped or hurt the president?
Well, that's a fair question. And in a sense, Florida has its own foreign policy because anything that affects Cuba, anything that affects Haiti affects Florida. So obviously that's something to watch. But also expanding on what Helen just said, look at the people who are not allowed to leave Cuba, the scientists, the doctors, the athletes, the people of means and substance. They can't leave. If it's just going to be Raul Castro getting rid of malcontents and people on the lower edge of society, one, that's really not exactly the kind of openness that a lot of people are thinking, and two, what does that mean for Florida and, you know, its ability to support that kind of migration?
Mark,
yep. Well.
Sure, exactly. That conversation. Mark, you're shaking your head. You spent a lot of time covering these things.
I agree. I think what's significant is is slowly and gradually the, while we, yeah, we have an embargo and restrictions, you go, especially you go to Tampa, there are almost daily flights now to Havana. The amount of travel to and from Cuba is remarkable. When I moved here from Tallahassee just last year, I was kind of surprised at the number of my child's classmates whose parents had come over from Cuba 2, 3, 4 years ago. It's slowly changing no matter what. At a certain point, the Castro dictatorship is going to fall to capitalism, whether it likes it or not. Castro probably had a stroke, we now hear. He's going to be checking out sooner or later, probably sooner rather than later. The one thing I do see foreign policy-wise that affects our domestic policy is the Cuban Adjustment Act, which gives Cubans a special immigration privilege, essentially a path to citizenship the minute that their foot hits dry land. You're going to see that start to change. And in the Hispanic community more broadly, the Cuban Adjustment Act is something that produces a good amount of tension because Mexicans now are saying, well, heck, how come these people are economic immigrants? They can come over from Cuba. They're allowed to stay in the United States, but I'm not because I'm from Mexico. And that's something you're hearing more and more of, and you're going to hear more and more pressure to change that.
How is the policy different between President Obama and Governor Romney on Cuba?
Well, it appears is that Romney wants to take a more hardline approach and scale back some of the loosening of restrictions that Obama has allowed, but he hasn't delved into that, and we're going to see over time that trade is trade. Romney likes trade. Heck, Paul Ryan was pretty much anti-embargo until relatively recently as he started to head up the ranks of power in the U.S. House. So at a certain point, it's going to be tougher and tougher to resist the changing and the opening of the world and of Cuba.
And to that point, that's been something that's really divided the Republican Party, precisely on the issue of trade and other states, Arizona, for example, Jeff Flake, wanting to increase the opportunities of trade towards the island. And I think that's one of the issues. When you can't forget also that there's Alan Gross, who's in jail in Cuba, and the implication that that has.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup. It is our presidential debate special from Lynn University here in Boca Raton. That voice, Helen Ferre from Univision Radio and WPBT Television, also with the RLS Americas, and Ken Rudin from NPR, the political junkie, and Mark Caputo from the Miami Herald. We welcome you back to the program. We do have a question from the audience here on Cuba Policy. Sir, welcome.
Hello. I want to make the pronouncement.
Tell us your name and where you're from first.
My name's Mike Trout. I'm a progressive independent candidate for Congress here in the 21st District.
Okay.
I'm going to start with making the pronouncement that our failed embargo policy with Cuba is schizophrenic. It fails to have any effect on the Cuban leadership, but it has a huge detrimental effect on 11 million Cubans. So if we wanted to push Cuba towards a more market-based economy, wouldn't it make sense to initiate more trade with the island?
Helen, I think you're probably the only one qualified to sort of answer that question. I mean, on this panel at least, there are people who say that doing this is just going to embolden the Castro government or whoever's in charge of the country that's certainly not capitalist at this point.
Well, there's no question that the United States can't do this effort alone. As the world turned on the government, the apartheid government in South Africa, it really requires an international effort. And I would suggest that if there are 11 people, a million people who are suffering in Cuba, it's because it's the fault of the Cuban government. The rest of the world trades, and they have benefits of working with European nations who have stopped contributing as much and working as much economically with Cuba because it hasn't quite paid off. The economic system is totally crumbled, so now they've handed it over to the Brazilian government to take over, including the sugar production, which is absolutely incredible. And the Brazilians are also working on restoring the Mariel port. So when you look at what's happening in Cuba, Cuba is making changes, but I think what they're trying to do is that can they do what the Chinese have done, held on to the military and political power, and then perhaps let this, you know, subcurrent of capitalism or opportunities for well, in Cuba, you don't have a middle class, but, you know, what could possibly be a burgeoning middle class without challenging the political power. And I think that is more or less what they're playing with, as well as Mark says, you know, sooner or later, there's going to be a political change. The calendar is going to kick in, and Fidel Castro and Raul are going to be gone. So who steps in after that?
Speaking of political change, there was an opportunity for some in Venezuela, and as we know, Venezuela and Cuba are linked together very, very strongly, with Venezuela sending about $10 billion a year in oil subsidies to Cuba, which is really helping that economy stay afloat. In Venezuela this month, Hugo Chavez was reelected to another six-year term, much to the chagrin of most Venezuelans living in the U.S., many of them in South Florida. What do you expect in terms of U.S. policy towards his leftist government going forward? And could this be a touchstone here in the final stretch of this election, how to deal with Hugo Chavez for the next 6 years?
Well, I think the Hugo Chavez election surprised many in the sense that no one anticipated that the margin was going to be, that 10% margin. And I think there is a lot of truth that there was fear as to what the repercussion would be for voting against Hugo Chavez and the lack of privacy, when it comes to voting in Venezuela and the manipulation of that voting information. But what you do see is that you do have a solid consolidation of opposition in Venezuela, and Enrique Capriles becomes the face of that opposition. Interestingly enough, he's running again for governor of Miranda, and it was fascinating to me when I was watching, and I was able to interview a number of journalists from Venezuela, and they said to me, you know, we can't say that the numbers are, we don't have the science to show that the numbers were manipulated, but Hugo Chavez winning in the province of Miranda is like Mitt Romney winning in Harlem. It's just impossible. And yet there you have it. And what we're going to be experiencing in South Florida, from what I've been able to garner from people that I've spoken to, is that those who have means and ability and an education from Venezuela are going to leave the country because they're not prepared for another 6 years.
Ken Rudin, Mitt Romney might take the Bronx, but what do you think on that comment?
Well, I don't think he'll win Harlem. No, I don't.
Manhattan, yeah.
But what he will do, I almost guarantee that Romney will bring up Venezuela and Hugo Chavez and its relationship with the Obama administration in the debate. And one of the reasons is because there was a comment, maybe it's an offhanded comment, not long ago from President Obama, said that in the scheme of things, Hugo Chavez is not a big deal, a big worry for the United States. And Romney's going to talk about Venezuela's relationship with Iran and Hezbollah and groups like that, and its oil money and its use of oil money in foreign policy, and I suspect that's going to be a big Romney talking point.
Remember, we're keeping the conversation going off the air as well. We're doing it on Twitter. If you use the hashtag LynnDebate and you use @WLRN, our social media folks will get that, and we can get the best stuff here on the air, and we'll continue the conversation after we go off the air as well. And again, you can tweet us with using the hashtag LynnDebate and the handle @WLRN. So geopolitically, though, this brings up a thought about conversations I've had with folks in Venezuela and journalists that cover Latin America about the creeping influence, if you will, of Iran on places like Venezuela, where, and in Bolivia for that matter, where you may have some leftist leaders that may try to receive Iranian government or become allies. Mark, how big an issue could that be here?
Well, I would imagine it's going to be a huge issue, because if you try to do things to the United Nations, you wind up in a very, you think our politics are complicated in Florida, you know, across the globe they're incredibly complicated. Hugo Chavez sits on a lot of oil, and as a result, he's got quite a trump card to play. Iran sits on a lot of oil. They've got a trump card to play, and both are essentially enemies of our government. So the destabilizing effect that has on us being able to accomplish our agenda worldwide can't be underestimated. Just back to the earlier discussion of the Venezuela elections, yeah, there's probably fraud there, but Hugo Chavez did what every politician dreams to do. He bribed the people with their own money. He actually gave away washing machines to people. In some cases, people got free houses. this is the kind of player we're dealing with.
$600. It was approximately $600 per vote that was cashed in on election day. So yeah. It's just absolutely astounding. But I think, but when you listen to what Mark and Phil say about the importance of Latin America and the influence of Iran in the hemisphere, the frustration many Hispanics have is that Washington doesn't seem to get that. And maybe it's because we're too close to it, I don't know. But the fact of the matter is, when you speak to political leadership, it's like, you know, it's not such a big deal. So what does it take for it to become a big deal in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, well, it's when people die. That's why Libya became an issue, because people died.
We were talking about this, though, before we get to the break, though. Where has the conversation about Latin America been in this entire campaign? It has not been there. Is it conspicuously absent? Or, as Ken talked about before, it's the economy stupid. But has there really been enough talk about all the things that we're talking about right now?
Well, I think it's a little complicated, especially for Obama. Free trade generally benefits a state like Florida. Free trade generally does not benefit a state like Ohio. That's also complicated for Romney. These are complicated things that you're talking about, and you're going against certain entrenched special interests, especially, again, in Ohio, in the Midwest. You have union workers who, by and large, blame a lot of their troubles on free trade agreements. This is not something Obama wants to go bragging about, and it's really not something that Romney wants to go talking about as well, especially with his recent very hardcore push in Ohio.
Another thing that has not been talked about is the situation in Haiti 3 years after the earthquake, and we haven't heard that much at all talked about during this presidential campaign. We, though, will be talking about that when we continue. You are listening to a special pre-debate edition of the Florida Roundup from Lynn University here in Boca Raton. I'm Phil Latzman. With us on the panel today, Helen Foray from Univision Radio and WPBT-TV, Ken Rudin from NPR, and Mark Caputo from the Miami Herald. We'll come back and continue the discussion in just a moment. And welcome back to our presidential debate special from Lynn University on the Florida Roundup. I'm Phil Latzman. Again, our panel, Mark Caputo, Ken Rudin, and Helen Foray. And as we continue talking about foreign policy issues here, before we get into the topic of Haiti and immigration, let's now bring in once again our social media producer and editor, Danny Rivero, who's been reading some of your tweets at hashtag LynnDebate at call sign WLRN. Danny, what you got for us?
Hey, Phil. So as far as foreign policy, some of the things that are coming up are people are concerned about what's going on with our military. People would like us to address the issues of drone and civilian casualties. What do the candidates feel about that? One person, Chris Lyons, 16, asked us, compared to the Middle East, Russia, and China, Venezuela is less of an issue. So I think the question is, are we paying so much attention to them because they're closer to us and we get the outflow of their exiles? Or, what's the real threat there?
Yeah, what's the real threat? And it's interesting, but this is an issue that could be more Florida-specific, and as we all know, Florida could decide the presidential election. So maybe it does, from a political standpoint, need a little bit more paying attention to.
Well, I mean, what's the threat of Fidel Castro taking over in 1959? You could say, well, it's a small island, it doesn't matter, but one, it's 90 miles away, and two, obviously it helped form the world almost went to war over Cuba, so I don't know if Venezuela represents that kind of threat, but given his relationship with Iran, who wants to expand its own sphere of influence and Hezbollah and things like that, it's something that it's the last thing the U.S. wants in its backyard.
And you can continue again tweeting us at hashtag LynnDebate and using the call sign at WLRN. And Helen, you want to add?
Want to jump in for a minute, and there are a couple of other issues when we look at how to view a threat. You don't have to view a threat as something that's necessarily catastrophic. But you can look and you can say, are we losing our influence in the hemisphere? And you see that Iran has, anything Iran-related has to worry the United States. And so the proximity with Venezuela, of course, is going to be something that we really have to be monitoring. And then Venezuela's influence on Cuba, you also have to be monitoring. The State Department considers Cuba a member of the terrorist nations and still classifies it as such. But you also see the growing influence of China in Latin America for economic reasons. So once you see that within our hegemony, that the powers that be begin to change without the threat necessarily of a nuclear weapon, there are other things that should be worrying us that I don't know we're keeping our eye on.
And while 4 years ago foreign policy was not the key issue, one of President Obama's arguments against the Bush administration was that Bush supported a go-it-alone foreign policy and the lack of respect the U.S. and influence the U.S. has in the world. And the question is, has the influence and respect of the U.S. increased or decreased in the past 4 years?
Let's move on to talking about Haiti, which is the issue that is not come up. It's still a mess, both structurally and politically, almost 3 years after the earthquake in January of 2010. Lots of Haitian Americans in South Florida and throughout the state, throughout the country for that matter these days. Do Haiti's continued struggles reflect on the Obama administration at all? Mark Caputo.
I don't know about that, but I think it's probably a good bet that we're going to see. They have all the makings of a coup in Haiti right now. There's no food, there's no shelter, there's the post-traumatic stress disorder of seeing 300,000 of your fellow citizens, some relatives and the like, die. It's a failed state, and it's right off of our shores. I know you don't want to do this, but I do want to transition back. You had mentioned defense and in our foreign policy. You know, one of the things that we should be talking about in foreign policy is our domestic policy. That's the effects of the so-called sequester that is going to come up. Now, that's $500 billion cut from defense over a decade. There's probably a lot of waste there. But remember this, in northeast Florida, you have at Jacksonville, where you have a naval base. In the southernmost part of the state, in Key West, you have a naval air station. And in the westernmost part of the state, you have an Air Force base. And you have MacDill, which is in Tampa. That's all defense spending. You know, there's one estimate 42,000 jobs could be affected by the defense cuts. That's a foreign policy issue, and that's also a domestic issue that I have yet to hear fully discussed in these debates or by the campaigns.
Yeah, sidebarring on this before we get back to the conversation, but I do want to talk about Haiti. But yes, in the debate, the last debate, Ken Rudin, it was discussed about when you were talking about adding to the deficit, to $2 trillion that President Obama claims he wants to cut from the defense budget that Mitt Romney actually wants to put back in. That's where the discussion has come in. And how is that factored into the conversation between these two candidates? And yeah, it does have a direct impact on foreign policy.
Well, it's the usual Republican issue, or at least the perceived Republican issue against the Democrats, that the Democrats are weak on defense, or certainly weak on defense spending, and Romney's obviously trying to fill, to make that case as well. But at the same time, when you have these unbelievable deficits, when you have people who just can't do anything because there's just no money for it, the argument is whether, even talk about the money for security in Libya, which became a heated issue in the last week's debate. A lot of it is money, a lot of it is budgeting for security, and that'll come up on Monday too.
All right, so back to Haiti for a second. You know, we just talked about how close it is to the U.S., how economically significant it is when things happen there, how it could impact Florida, especially South Florida. The U.S. has a history of intervention there. We send enormous amounts of aid, thousands of NGOs there, spending hundreds of millions of dollars. It all has the elements of a place that should be sort of a bigger part of the discussion on U.S. foreign policy. So why isn't it more in that discussion, Helen?
You know, Phil, I think there's, I think it's people don't even know what to do anymore. Mark was talking about that the country is ripe for a coup. The OAS has intervened more than once. There's been a lot of international attention. But there comes a point in time when you look at it and you say, is it time to just say that Haiti is a failed state? And once you do that, what is the international obligation thereafter? Do we consider that we have a humanitarian role to play with Haiti? And it can't be just the United States. This has to be something where you look at the international community and you look at the Organization of American States and you look at the United Nations. And if we can't get the island of Haiti right, of that part of Hispaniola, which also has a detrimental effect to what happens to the Dominican Republic as well, right, because the Dominican Republic takes in so many people who migrate from Haiti, then what can we expect from even larger and broader issues?
What about wet foot, dry foot? Cubans have that policy. You get here, if you're onshore, you're safe. Haitians do not have that policy.
You know,
it's
I
long
never
been talked about a
I
double standard
I never understood
here.
Wet foot, dry foot. I thought wet foot, dry foot was always a policy that was going to say, you come here illegally, and as long as I don't know about it, it's okay. It's like a don't ask, don't tell type of thing. And I never understood why that was appropriate. And if anything, it really created human trafficking and smuggling to a large degree, which I think is just absolutely horrible. And that, you know, people pay thousands of dollars and sometimes get literally dumped in the water as soon as they see the Coast Guard. And we don't even have a count as to how many people we've lost in that trajectory. It's just horrible.
Now, that's going to transition us to immigration. We're going to talk about that in a moment. Ken, go ahead.
I just don't know why that. Why haven't they thought of, like, if Bain Capital bought Haiti and just worked on it, I think they can make a big difference. It's a possible idea.
No, no problem there.
You're going to get in trouble for that one.
Let's take a couple of questions from the audience members here at Lynn University. We have a young lady up front. Welcome to the program. Good to
Thank
have you.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Danielle Mattson from the Palm Beach County Young Republicans. I just want to thank WLRN at Lynn University and the Miami Herald for having us today. My question for you is, what could have been done to prevent the deaths that occurred as a result of the attack on the Libyan embassy?
Well, if we were in that position...
having the gift of prophecy probably would have helped. It seems as if it was a very well orchestrated and organized attack. And it seems as if, in retrospect, the administration and those on the ground should have known that an attack was coming. So I would think in hindsight, if they could do it over again, they probably would have abandoned the consulate in Libya, or better said, in Benghazi. I'm not sure what size Marine Guard you could have had to have prevented an attack of that scale. So going forward, I would imagine it would be scaling back on these more vulnerable targets and hardening the targets that you decide to keep.
I don't know if the Obama administration is responsible. Certainly the fact that it happened on 9/11 should have been a signal that certain measures should have been taken care of. And apparently there were cables from the compound to the State Department said, look, we need more security. And when President Obama was asked that question in last week's debate, he really didn't give it an answer. So I don't think that's as much as an issue as the fact is, and kind of Romney tripped himself up during this debate about whether the president used the words act of terror right away. But the point is there had been conflicting messages coming from the State Department, from Susan Rice at the UN, from the administration for 14 days. And I think that becomes one of Obama's major vulnerabilities on foreign policy.
I think the big vulnerability is that we dropped the ball. I think that the security that should have been there wasn't there. Ambassador Chris Stevens had indicated that he was on a list where he was going to be a target of terrorists months before. And particularly on 9/11, the appropriate measures weren't taken, which is not to say you weren't going to have an attack wasn't going to occur, but we weren't as well prepared as we should have, and I think everybody agrees to that. I think that Governor Romney should have waited before coming out with his pronouncement, but I also think that the administration has been woeful in admitting culpability and having not done what it needed to do.
All right, we're going to talk about immigration, which is another fault line between these two candidates and how they differ in just a moment. Now, at a Univision forum that was held at the University of Miami, President Obama said the failure to pass comprehensive immigration reform was his fault, but that Republicans didn't make it easy. We could hear that.
Jorge, as you remind me, my biggest failure so far is we haven't gotten comprehensive immigration reform done. So we're going to be continuing to work on that. But it's not for lack of trying or desire, and I'm confident we're going to accomplish that.
And also talking about deferred action, this summer the Obama administration granted temporary reprieves for children of undocumented immigrants. After 2 years, we'll see how this works out. Now, this is Mitt Romney at the Univision Forum commenting on the deferred action program.
These kids deserve something better than temporary. They deserve a permanent solution. And my view is that the ideas that were being brought forward by Senator Marco Rubio, those were things that should have been pursued. We should have had an answer. And my specific request is that for those young people who, for instance, serve at our military, that they should be able to become a permanent resident of the United States. That's the kind of model I think that will work for these young people.
So that goes into the discussion here, especially I think that resonates in South Florida, is the discussion over the DREAM Act and how that did not get passed and what might happen in a second term for President Obama or a first term for Mitt Romney. Before we get into that, what do you guys think? Well, talk about the DREAM Act and how this might figure as well in this conversation. Ken?
Well, I think that the problem is, first of all, the Republican Party realizes that the fastest growing demographic in this country is the Latino population. But they didn't seem to realize it during the Republican primaries and caucuses, when the debate was very incendiary and turned off a lot of people from undocumented folks. First of all, Mitt Romney, throughout the primaries and caucuses, called them illegals, which is offensive to many people. He criticized Rick Perry for allowing undocumented people to go to pay in-state tuition in Texas. He criticized Newt Gingrich for talking about lack of deportation. But then it seems like there's been a reverse course. Not that Romney's ever embraced the DREAM Act, but he has said that maybe if you serve in the military, that could be a path to citizenship. There's a different sound from Mitt Romney. The question is whether it's too little, too late.
We're going to save the last couple of minutes here for our audience here at Lynn University. Young lady, step forward and welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. My name is Krista, and I'm a student here at Lynn University. And my question is, if Romney is elected, do you think that it is possible that the Arizona immigration law will become law for the rest of the country?
Well, the Arizona immigration law is a state law to begin with. And I'm not sure that the federal government can require local police to enforce federal laws. I would also look at what's going on in the Senate, look what's going on in Congress, and nothing's happening. So it's a safe bet to bet that nothing occurs simply because it's a do-nothing Congress.
And we've heard the state of Florida talking about immigration laws nothing has come close to what they had proposed in Arizona. And I think the legislature is pretty set on not making too many changes to make it Arizona style. We have one more question from the audience, another young lady. Ma'am, welcome to the program. What's your question?
Good afternoon. My name is Charlene Charles from Boca Raton, Florida, a senior at Olympic Heights High School. And I would like to know, how could America make the immigration process quicker of those coming from Haiti?
All right. The last question, and Helen, you want to sum it up?
And of course, that's the big challenge, how to make everybody wants legal immigration, and how to provide immigration and how to improve it in a way, particularly for humanitarian reasons, which I guess we would absolutely all agree. One of the things that I really lament, and I think both parties have really dropped the ball on immigration reform, you can blame both Republicans and Democrats for this. Democrats, because they don't want to get into trouble with labor unions, so you don't even get temporary work permits, and Republicans, who have been very hostile towards undocumented, which they call, it's fascinating to me, even the New York Times thinks that saying illegal immigrants is being accurate somehow without understanding that for Hispanics, when you say illegals, many people use that as a term that's derogatory and that's being anti-Hispanic. The Republican Party has changed its tone, which, thank the Lord, is doing that. If anything good comes out of this election cycle, I think what we're going to be seeing is that immigration reform, which has so divided us, is finally going to be dealt with in a proper way.
All right, well, that's going to have to be the last word. We should say the Obama administration has deported nearly 1.2 million immigrants, most of them Latinos, in the last 3 years. I'd like to thank our panel here, Ken Rudin from NPR, a political junkie. It's great to have you down here. Thanks very much for your time. Also, Helen Ferrey from WPBT-TV, and also from the Diarios Los Americas and Univision Radio. Helen, thank you.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Mark Caputo, political lead reporter, political reporter for the Miami Herald.
Not used to being applauded. Uh-huh. Not used to being applauded. Totally unaccustomed to
applause. I think you're handling it quite well. That does it for the Florida Roundup Presidential Debate Special from Lynn University. We are a production of WLRN Miami Herald News. You can find out more about us, including an archive of our past shows, on our Facebook page. Look for the Florida Roundup on WLRN or at our brand new website, WLRN.org. Florida Roundup is produced by Alicia Zuckerman. Sammy Mack and Elaine Chen are associate producers. Danny Rivero is a social media editor. Our executive producer for WLRN is Peter J. Meritz. Our news director is Dan Gretsch for WLRN Miami Herald News. Today's technical supervisors, Chris DeAngelis, Paul Leary back at WLRN, Caroline Brader-Watts as well, and IT support from Charles Michaels. For everyone here at Lynn University in Boca Raton, thanks for listening. I'm Phil Latzman. Stay informed, Florida.